awesome. So we, first and foremost, I definitely want to talk to you about B2B brands with getting into the ROI of social media, because one of the things that we always talk about in social media and in what you do for clients, which I'd love to actually explore a little bit in terms of what you do. But what is ROI in social media? This is one of the biggest things that people are like, what the heck? You know, it's a different definition every which way. So I'm curious, what's yours?
Yeah, well, you know, I come at from the angle as a CEO, right? So I have a P&L statement to deal with. And, you know, obviously our business is social media. So we wouldn't have much business if we weren't producing a return on our clients' investment in social media. So I think social media, the ROI is a couple of things. Obviously, it's growing the business through brand awareness. It's engagement. So creating more engagement for the brand, helping to humanize the brand, helping the brand to tell their story on social media. But really for me, the juice or the secret sauce is revenue. So we track revenue that is driven through social media campaigns and initiatives. And in fact, one of our clients was able to track almost $40 million in revenue driven by social media.
What? Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Can you give us a little bit of insight into like, how do you track that? Or what is like, what's the, well, obviously without going into the secret sauce, but what, how do you even get 40 million? Even how about 1 million?
Well, that's easy. You know, really what you're using is you're using your CRM system. So, you know, maybe you're using Salesforce, you're using Marketo, but if you set it up, you can actually track all of your social media initiatives and your campaigns so that, you know, so say someone out there, you know, CMO or a marketing professional, you know, they're going to have to produce to the executive team what their spend got them in business growth, or you can see that budget go away. And we're seeing that in B2B, right? So, you know, I have a heart for the marketer out there who is seeing their social media, you know, not only slashed, but killed sometimes because their marketing budget is cut. In fact, I was talking to someone today whose marketing budget was cut by 2/3. So they have 1/3 left to try to accomplish, right? This whole list of things they have to accomplish in order to drive business growth. So really what we've done to position Thulium is to help marketers actually document, record, and achieve success with building the business. That means revenue driven through social media. And you do that really smartly, Brian. You know, I see companies using social media all wrong. And I think it's because of a misperception. I think that a lot of people went into social media thinking that it was about popularity. But you and I both know, and I think you and I have both experienced this, you can be really popular on social media and have absolutely no one buying. Mm-hmm. So it's not about popularity. And so I think when organizations are really looking at popularity metrics, when they're looking at follower counts, that's all wrong. They're looking at the wrong thing and they're being distracted by that which does not build the business, by that which does not drive any sort of conversions or growth in revenue. And so I really, you know, I'm out there all the time trying to educate people that it's not about popularity or numbers. It's about delivering real value. It's about real engagement. And it's about solving problems for people in such an exquisite way that the brand becomes the go-to thought leader in that space.
I am also interested in some of the best practices that you would love to see go away.
I have to say, the one thing that drives me absolutely bananas is no matter what we say about engaging with your audience, about, you know, exquisite storytelling, about, you know, content that is meaningful, you still have executives who don't understand social media, who think it's about follower counts, what I just said. And they're like, we need more followers. And I'm like, no, what you need is more buyers, right? It's not followers, it's conversions, it's buyers. And so I think what's interesting is I wish we could get rid of this whole thing about the vanity metrics, right? Which is, how many followers does our organization have? How many followers does, you know, this person who is interacting with us have? How many followers does this influencer have? Because follower counts mean absolutely nothing. They don't mean anything about influence. They don't mean anything about driving conversions. They mean nothing. So if we could get rid of that, and I think the reason that's still hanging around is just it's a really old popularity piece, and it has never made mathematical sense. There's no quantitative analysis that says your popularity translates into money. Doesn't, unless you happen to be, you know, a movie star, right? And I mean, like a real, not a self-proclaimed personality, but a real personality. So other than that, for the rest of us real people, it's really about the quality of your offering, you know, what problems you're solving and how you're interacting. You have to be a brand that interacts. And I think that we're not using the right metrics because those are a little bit more difficult to get to versus what seems to be easy. And that's looking at follower count. So if I could get rid of that, if I could banish that from everyone's mind, and if I could really communicate that some of the most influential people in the world don't have hardly any followers.
Wow. Okay. So you're saying that there are some people out there that have maybe just a handful of followers and have the influence that you require for some of the campaigns or some of the things that you're doing or some of the people that are doing extraordinary things out there, that is a possibility, and the follower count or even the likes or the retweets or all that kind of stuff isn't really what it bottom lines to.
Exactly. It's what does this person that's trusted say? And they're trusted because they happen to be an expert and not a popularity person. It's like, you know, in the B2C realm, popularity is everything, but we're talking B2B. So in B2C, okay, yeah, there's a lot of people who care what Kim Kardashian says or does, and they may buy that lip gloss. But in B2B, you don't drive digital transformation within the organization and enterprise solution sale, which usually typically, if you look at the sales cycle, the gestation of a sale of an enterprise solution, you're looking at minimum 12 months, more like 18 months for that conversion. That's not going to be something, you know, you may think Kim Kardashian's popular, but no one's going to make a purchasing decision in B2B based on what a popular person has to say, because it's not a trusted advisor. I mean, these are really complicated pieces within an organization. You know, when you choose your cloud migration, it's not because of what Joe Schmo, who has a billion followers, said. There's a lot of pieces within that make you decide that your IT department is going to invest in this solution.
What I'm curious about is where the next decade is going to go. What is corporate leadership thinking when it comes to decisions that they're going to make and changes and things that might be different from the last decade?
So corporate leadership with respect to social media, they still don't have it. They just still don't understand it. It's been around, but they genuinely, most senior level executives do not understand social media. And most of them, you know, aren't on it that often, or their comms teams are on there for them. And so not understanding social media creates a lot of problems, because when you don't understand something, you usually are making poor decisions. So within that realm, I think we're still behind the eight ball with respect to senior leadership truly understanding the value and the power of social media done right. And then leadership in general is changing as we have more and more of the workforce that have different views about work. And, you know, as we are looking at more into the gig economy. And we have two generations now. We have Gen Z and we have millennials in the workforce, neither of which are too keen on positional power authority. What I mean by that is, generations before, if somebody was an executive, you didn't approach them, right? They had this level of authority and there was a little bit more separation. What these two generations, and I'm talking younger millennials. Can I be frank here? Some of these millennials out there are not young. So they're not included in this topic. I'm talking about the younger millennial, not the older millennial trying to act like the younger millennial, but the young millennial and the Gen Z are kids still, not those that are in their 30s. Those aren't kids. The kids these days don't see a difference between themselves and someone in an authoritative position. And that is really changing the game for leadership within organizations because the behaviors, the culture of the younger set is much different. And so what we see is a bit of a culture clash at times. And then, I think part of that, it's not just the generational cohorts. I also think it's age. Don't you think, Brian? Like, didn't you just not know some things until you experienced them? And so I think, we might blame everything on a generational cohort, but I think some of it is just, lack of experience. And but I do think one of the refreshing things about the younger generation coming up, and I'm really speaking to Gen Z now because those are really our kids that are coming up now, are these Gen Z kids. The refreshing thing is that they want even something different than the millennials did. Gen Z really does care about money. They do care about making money. Gen Z will do a job that makes money that they don't necessarily enjoy because they want the financial security. Gen Z is a generational cohort that is worried about the future, whereas the millennial, really was more about the experience. I know this job doesn't pay much, but I want an experience, or I'm job hopping because I want experiences. So now we have these two generations that are very different from one another. And, there's projections out there that actually Gen Z will be the bosses of the millennials. Each generation brings with it a freshness. They bring with it challenging the, status quo. They bring all kinds of things. I mean, we're Gen Xers, right? I'm making an assumption here, but I assume you're a Gen X with me, Brian. But, I think we were the original rule breakers. We just don't get any credit because our generational cohort is so tiny. We're so small, no one ever paid attention to it. We're like the middle child.
We've got all the machine learning and AI and all this great technology that's coming. And I'm just curious where you're heading. Where are you leaning towards all this?
Nothing is all rosy. And anyone who says it is, all of us know in our guts, they're not saying the whole truth because there is a dark side. There's a shadow to everything. There's a shadow to each one of us, by the way. So I think what, I'm most interested in moving forward is I'm diving into a lot of attention and work globally on policy, public policy, and ethics around artificial intelligence, machine learning, and genetic engineering, all these nascent technologies that, just 2 years ago, it was in 2018, November of 2018, we had the first twins, the first babies born that have been genetically modified using CRISPR technology. So, that was November of 2018.
And by CRISPR, I don't think you're referring to like Kentucky Fried Chicken or anything like that. You want to explain like what CRISPR is?
Yeah, so CRISPR is a, just to make it just palatable for whoever happens to be watching. CRISPR is a technology where you can go in and actually edit genes. You can actually edit a gene with, you know, with consequences, right? So here's the deal. Like if you go in to genetically modify an embryo, you also don't know the long-term consequences of that edited gene, right? So we are in the baby, infant stages, embryonic stages of gene editing, and a lot of mistakes can be made. And so there's a lot of ethical considerations because, you know, you look at, you know, did these twins have a choice? And we don't know the long-term consequences of the editing of their genes. And so, you know, if we see that that's already been done, we know it's going to happen again and again and again. We're already, you know, the genie's out of the bottle. We're down the path. So we may be, with technology in the future, editing out, think about it. If we're editing out all the little things we don't like about ourselves, you say a couple's going to have a child and they're like, oh, we want blue eyes. We want chestnut hair. We want, you know, I don't, my dad had this thing and I don't want that. And my mom had. So if we start doing designer babies, designer humans, we're going to edit out diversity. We're going to edit out all of our flaws. But I would argue these flaws are what make us interesting, what make us individuals, which, you know, we don't want to. Do we really want to be perfect? And I don't believe that there's such a thing. I do believe there are consequences that we haven't thought of yet in trying to build perfect beings. So we have that scary piece, why I want to get involved in policy and ethics. But this other piece has to do with artificial intelligence and machine learning. So you look at, you know, the technology that you could have a neural implant implanted, right? Think of Elon Musk's Neuralink, right? So if you have the ability to connect directly into the internet, and think about this, you no longer have this. See, we're augmented already, okay? Because none of us want to leave without this. If you have a question, you immediately get an answer. So we're augmented already. Let's not kid ourselves. But this is the next level of augmentation where you don't even have to have an external device. You can just know, which means theoretically that you could be omniscient to a point. Like you could know whatever you could possibly access on a computer.
Like the Matrix.
So I would say to anyone watching, Brian, how many of you, if you were offered the ability to get a neural implant so that you would never lose your memory and you would be incredibly smart, how many of you would get it? And then it's not, those of you who are like, no way. I want to tell you the minute that one person says yes way, you're pressured to do it. Because the minute the first person augments themselves is the minute the rest of us can't compete in business or in education. Well, in fact, that's going to disrupt education. How's a professor supposed to teach students who already know everything, right? So we are creating what I believe to be another species of human being. We are creating augmented humans. And in creating a new species of human, are we ready to live with the consequences of our actions? And so, you know, a lot of people might go, oh, Tamara, that's so far off. And yes, it may be so far off. But if we don't start thinking about these things now, it's going to be too late. When we're like, oh, yeah, it's in our present day, it's too late. So these are the things we have to start discussing now. And to, you know, the other piece with public policy and ethics is we will have a wider divide between the haves and the have nots. And mind you, it's going to be a very, very small subset of individuals who will have the power to make decisions because everybody else hasn't been involved or doesn't know enough to be involved. And so I'm just afraid we're not going to like the tomorrow we wake up in unless we all wake up now and start becoming involved in these conversations. And I mean, everybody being involved, you know, from average citizens, because right now the only people involved in these conversations are scientists, people involved in, you know, AI, engineers, we all need to be involved in this conversation. And I think sometimes people feel left out because they don't think they can talk about these things. But I would really like to bring these subjects to a lay conversation to get people thinking, get them involved so that we're not lulled to sleep and distracted, so that things happen to us instead of us being engaged in creating our future.
I think that right there was a TED talk. But what was the original spark that led you to build your companies or start on the path you did to get you to where you're now talking about this kind of stuff?
Well, I'm a geek, and I'm insatiably curious. And I was raised by my late father was just this amazing inventor, entrepreneur. He, you know, the highest education he finished was he graduated high school. He never went to college. He was a brilliant man and made all kinds of fun, awesome inventions. And he, you know, we grew up in the middle of six kids, and we grew up in a family business, all pitching in. And I guess I have that in my blood to want to be an entrepreneur, to challenge assumptions, to create new ways of doing things, to look at things from a different angle and, you know, not necessarily get lost swimming with the crowd. So I think, you know, my dad had a huge influence on me, and I think my patience, you know, you mentioned my background starting out in life, my very first job as a registered nurse, and, you know, really loving that, loving patient care. I love fixing problems. To me, like, I'm the worst friend when you just want to hang out and party, but I'm your best friend when you have a really bad problem and you need to solve it, because I love taking problems and trying to solve them and solving problems for my patients. And, you know, doing trauma nursing and life flight helicopter nursing, I love that, because when you're a first responder in the field, it's not all neat and tidy and you don't have all the equipment and things that you need. So you just make stuff up and you make it work. And I liked that. And then the problem, you know, lots of my patients were, you know, had cancer. And so that's what got me interested in wanting to go back to school to cure cancer, study molecular physiology, because, you know, there must be something in our environment or something that we're doing that's, you know, causing, you know, our metabolism to go bonkers, you know. And so don't even get me started on our mitochondria and where I think that stems into, you know, autoimmune diseases and cancer. But, you know, I think there are, I love hacks. I love hacking things. I love finding a way around it. And I care very much about people and, you know, the existential question of, like, why are we here? What did we come for? And I believe everybody came for a reason and everybody has something to contribute. And I'm just wildly passionate about technology and human beings. And I think technology can be used for good. I know I mentioned a lot of shadow, and I'm sorry. There's a lot of positives, and the positive cohabitation with technology will come if we make very conscious decisions and we are consciously considering our creations and why we're creating it in the betterment of human beings always first and foremost versus profit for a few pockets.
Mm, that's beautiful. So there's so many different things in there that lead me to believe that you're, like, always up. Because how do you stay on top of all of that? Like, that's all of these things are constantly growing. It's growing faster than it's ever grown before. You know, I missed 20 years ago when the TV had 13 channels. Wasn't that a nice time? So, you know, it's not that long ago. And now it's like the TV channels are abundant, let alone the ways that we can sell, market, and create companies and look at technology and do all these wonderful things. And yet you come across as though you're staying on top of it, or you're really into this. And I'm curious, how do you both run a company and take all that information in and have time for life?
Well, I'm addicted to reading. I read all the time. And I love to read, and, you know, I'm always staying abreast of, you know, what's new, what's coming out, all these nascent technologies, the applications. I'm really, you know, keen on the practical applications, and then future casting into, well, what's next, not only the next leap, but I'm always trying to, you know, like a chess move, I'm trying to look 10 moves ahead of what that would mean and what the longitudinal consequences are for X, Y, or Z. And so, you know, I don't watch TV, and I know, you know, I just don't get enjoyment out of TV. So I'm not dissing you if you like TV, but I'm either reading or I'm watching documentaries, because I love documentaries as well. And I just, I don't sleep a lot, and my husband can attest to that. Mike likes to sleep, but I don't. And I try, I just can't. And I guess my mind is always going, and I don't require a lot of sleep. I have a lot of energy, and I can't explain why. And it's definitely not from caffeine, because I won't show the product, but it's just water, like, you know, just sparkling water, and that fuels me. But it takes time, Brian. You're right. You know, I think we can get distracted and we can whittle away precious time. And so we have to think about 24 hours in our day and how we want to spend it. And how we want to spend it is critical, right? Because it's about our experience of the 24 hours. And so if you want to experience binge watching your favorite Netflix show, then enjoy it fully. Be in it and don't regret it. But if you say, oh, gee, I don't have time to write my book, and you're binge watching all the time, I'm going to say, well, you do have time. You're just choosing to use your time doing something else. So it's really about owning our time and taking responsibility for our time. And, you know, if there's something that you're not doing that you wish you would be doing, you know, look at all the ways in which we waste time. You know, I love, Brian, I told you I read a lot, right? I'm such a goof, but I love studying successful people. And so I love biographies as well. And I like the autobiographies, and, you know, I've read a lot about Warren Buffett, and it's really interesting. He's a master of focus. And I think for a lot of the time, the reason we don't achieve things is we have a lack of focus, or we're very distracted. And one of the things that I read about Warren Buffett was he said, you know, he would tell, you know, people he was mentoring, you know, write the 25 things down. And I'm getting this number wrong because I'm paraphrasing, but write 25 things down that you would like to achieve or accomplish. And then after you write those 25 things down, he would say, circle the five, your top five. And then the person would circle the top five. And then you'd say, okay, now erase all the rest. Forget about it. Don't think about it again. Put no energy toward the rest. Only focus on the five. And I thought that was pretty wild, because I tried that exercise. It's not easy. I would challenge anyone to try that, because I think what happens is we don't like to let go of the other 20 things. Because when we say no to, when we say yes to the five only, we're saying no to the other 20. And we have a hard time with that, because we want everything. But the truth is, you can have anything you want. You just can't have everything you want. And we hate to make choices, but we have to make choices. And those choices mean that we have time to focus, energy to focus. And that's what will drive success. But not everybody is going to be willing to do that. There's a price for success.
I really appreciate you being here today and sharing all of your wealth of knowledge with everybody else. And we hope to see you soon.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Spencer here on the Lead Tail team. I wanted to thank our guest today, Tamara McCleary. If you would like to continue the conversation, tweet us at Lead Tail or our guest at Tamara McCleary.
If you want to see the full video interview series, you can find this episode and more at leadtailtv.com. Please make sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Have ideas for the show? Do you know someone who would be great to be a guest? Drop us a line at studios@leadtail.com. Thanks.